Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
On the 20th of November, 1974, the Labour MP John Stonehouse, once tipped as a future Prime Minister, rolled his clothes into a neat bundle, left them on the beach in Miami, went for a swim and vanished. In the words of his wife, all the evidence that we've had points to the fact that he was drowned. Obituaries were prepared and his apparent death was widely thought to have been suicide. But on the 24th of December, he was arrested in Australia. And what happened next and the story of that has been rumbling around for years. Years until now, when we can talk to someone who knows the story. Obviously, the daughter of Julia Stonehouse, of John Stonehouse, just brought out a book called My Father, The True Story of the Runaway MP. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Julia to the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Bill.
Yes, well, let's first of all ask the blindingly journalistically obvious question, why now for the book, Julia?
I've been thinking about doing it for years, obviously, but I'm 70, my mother's 90, and really, you know, we couldn't kind of delay it anymore.
Yeah.
Plus, what's happening is that people are taking the old narrative, which is wholly incorrect, and spinning it. So now we've got, you know, podcasts and, you know, this, that and the other, all the kind of modern variation on the spin. And it's all completely out of control. So there really was no choice, really, but to write the book.
There is another book written by Julian Hayes, the son of his nephew and a guy who's also a lawyer. This is an interesting kind of parallel to this because they're almost out at the same time and that couldn't be a more different view. And I'm guessing that your book is to put the record straight.
Yeah. I mean, the difference between my book and his book is that I have over 300 references and he has none. he has completely ignored the testimony of the customs officer in Melbourne who essentially proved that Sheila was innocent, which was not given to the defence team until midway through the trial at the Old Bailey. And then they had a mad scramble to try and get a statement from him. Obviously, he's an official, so that took time, and yep. He'd broken his leg, and his mother couldn't find him, and all kinds of things. But essentially, the statement did arrive at the Old Bailey, but by then it was too late. For 16 months, people had been going with the idea that Sheila was in it from the beginning. And while Julian gives 8 pages to the accusation, he gives not one word to the statement that proves all of that was wrong. And I have a lot of gripes about his book, especially to do with the Czech spy file.
Yeah.
omissions, exaggerations, this, that, and the other. And I'm going to have to do a website and put all of that, or, you know, all of my kind of comments about it online, because it's just outrageous what he's done. I'm furious about it.
No, I gathered
you.
I gathered that in reading. Yeah. Let me just go back, if we can, to you and your father. What are your memories before all of this took place?
You know what's been completely lost in the whole story about John Stonehouse is that he was actually a very nice man.
Yeah.
He was a great father. He was a lot of fun. He was terribly supportive. He was so generous with everybody, and with his time, with his money, with everything that a man can give, he was generous. And yet, what happened with that story, because people, you know, the spy accusation, which started in 1960, and that then kind of did the rumor mill amongst parliamentarians and press, there was no proof. I mean, nobody could open the file until 2008. He'd been dead 20 years by that time.
Yes.
So nobody could prove anything one way or the other. But the accusation was there, and it lost him his entire political career, because, you know, what people say is no smoke without fire and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, here we're talking about, you know, a spy file that these people created for any number of British people and politicians. And, you know, they're all probably equally meaningless.
Yeah, for those of our listeners who are not aware of this side of the story, and I must confess, I only had kind of hazy memories of this part of it, that many since concluded that your father was an agent for the Eastern Bloc, and people may remember that during the Cold War there was a concerted effort by the Kremlin and its Warsaw Pact allies to recruit MPs and trade unionists as sources of information. And this is all down to this Czech intelligence organisation, the STB. And I've seen you in writing and saying that, you know, the accusation that your father was a traitor to his country is the worst thing that could have been heaped upon him.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, imagine being called a traitor to your country. Mm. And the thing was, nobody was more anti-communist than him. When he was president of the London Cooperative Society, which was the largest retail trading organisation in the country at the time, he had to fight the communists who were trying to take over the organisation. And I spent my childhood, you know, licking stamps and stuffing envelopes with anti-communist material, basically. Yeah. So, you know, the whole notion that people are saying, oh, you know, he supported the communists and so on, all of that's nonsense. But the important thing is, what's in this file? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I have it from the person who knows about these files, that there is nothing classified in there, no state secrets. I have gone through every single document in that file, and I've put all of that material to the back of the book because it's actually quite boring. But because I'm his daughter, people are going to say, oh, you know, she's partisan and she's, you know, making exaggerations or she's omitting and all of that. No, I am a professional ghostwriter of nonfiction books. That's what I do all day long.
Yeah.
And consequently, I have to approach this as a historical record, but I put it at the back of the book. But there were forces at the time who were trying to plug the story that he was a spy, because they were trying to bring down the Wilson government.
Yes.
You know, we had right-wingers trying to bring down, just as Profumo had been brought down in, you know, the Conservative government by Christine Keeler, you know, having slept with, you know, the Minister of War plus a bloke from the Russian embassy. You know, there were people who were trying to repeat that, but in the Labour government. And anyway, so this accusation, what is in the spy file? I have itemised every single document, you know, that's in there. And people can go through it. And what happens is people come along and they exaggerate it. Where you've got one letter, they say it's correspondence, implying that it's more than one letter. Mm. And if you look at the actual letter, anyway, there's no secrets in this file. The question is, this low-level information in there, where did it come from? And was he paid for providing this low-level information? That's what everybody calls it.
Yeah.
So he's a lady who is a professor who is the expert on the file. You know, she's looked at it and had been asked on the radio, low-level information, the kind of stuff you can get from newspapers and so on. And she said, well, it's more like gossip. Mm. So we go from spy to gossip. Let's just get this in perspective here.
Yes, yes.
And in the file itself, they say that he gave them the kind of information you can get from newspapers. And I've got a document from the file which says they refer to Hansard, which is the parliamentary, every day, what happened in Parliament was you got the whatever's happening in Parliament. And then that is printed overnight, and it was available as a printed copy of Hansard's parliamentary proceedings available at Her Majesty's Station Office every morning. And this is what they read. And it's in, they say that in the file. So the information in there, they could have got from, you know, the newspapers or from Hansard.
Yes.
You know, that's the kind of information that's in there. And the problem here is that my father did meet with the Czechs because he twinned his constituency of Wednesbury with the Czechoslovakian town of Kladno also.
Right.
When he was a minister, he was trying to sell them VC-10 aeroplanes.
Yes.
So there are meetings which were genuine, which now the spies have mixed up with non-genuine meetings. And you can pretty much see which is which.
Mm.
If you know the file well, which I do, and you analyse it properly. But, you know, people don't do that. You know, they say, oh, you know, we had loads of meetings and, you know, they gave him money. Well, you know, there's a map in there, which is in my book, which my father was supposed to have drawn, showing where his car was parked so they could put money in it, except it's not in his handwriting. You know, it doesn't even look like the street it's supposed to be.
Goodness,
it's a forgery.
Me. Goodness.
So, you know, they didn't even have our correct address, you know, Bill.
Wow. I guess there's that expression, isn't there, Julia? You'd never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Oh, my God. That is completely it. This is what my mother said to me the other day.
Yeah.
This is what this is all about. Never let the truth get in the way of a good story. You've nailed it. That is it right there.
Hmm. So let's talk about this bizarre Reggie Perrin side, which for those who are of a certain age like me will remember that scene at the start of the show where Reggie walks into the sea. What was happening then in his mind? Firstly, why was he in Miami? And then why did he then deposit his clothes with an attendant, go into the sea and not come back? It was clearly premeditated because, you know, there was clearly some planning went on. It wasn't a spur of the moment thing.
No.
What's that all about? Because you must have asked yourself that question a billion times over, and you have some answers in the book which are fascinating.
Well, what none of us realised, not him, not I, not my mother, not the lawyers, not the police, nobody realised, was that he was overdosing on a drug called Mandrax.
Yep.
And also taken with another drug called Mogadon. But Mandrax has been banned since 1984 because it literally drives you crazy.
Yeah.
It's known, it's methaqualone, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And it's known, it's methaqualone with a bit of antihistamine, to be honest. But the basic drug there is methaqualone. And it's called Quaaludes in America.
Yes.
So what had happened with him was that when he was a minister of, a junior minister at the Colonial Office in 1966. He was flying all over the world, okay? And he needed to sleep on the planes because when he got off the plane, he was straight into shaking hands and doing business. So he would take a methaqualone on the plane and put a little label on himself saying, please don't wake me up. You know, I've been fed and watered. I don't need anything. I need to sleep.
Yes.
And so he was used to taking this drug on an ad hoc basis, you know, without any side effect. From 1966, when it got to 1972, there was a lot of pressure that he came under, and now he started overdosing.
Mm.
And then he got the pills from a multitude of sources because the MPs that were also GPs, and he'd see them walking down the corridor, he'd get a prescription from them and then from another one, then from his own doctor, and then from the House of Commons doctor. When my mother went to Australia, you know, basically as soon as he reappeared on Christmas Eve, she flew to Australia, and then I moved to their house temporarily, you know, to hold the fort, as it were. The house was besieged, you know, by reporters, you know.
Yeah.
So, and the phone was ringing constantly. So I went and stayed there. They had separate bathrooms. And so my mother wasn't aware of what was in my father's bathroom cabinet, which I then became when I stayed there in the guest bedroom, and I open up the cupboard and it's got three rows of little bottles of Mandrax and Mogadon. And I'm thinking, well, what's all this? But I didn't clock then, Bill, because nobody knew then that these drugs...
The connection.
You know, they drive you crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, just look up the side effects of Mandrax or Mandy's, as they're known on the street. They're a street drug.
Yes.
And he was slowly being driven mad. He started overdosing when he became really stressed. And I think they literally drove him crazy. I mean, he was going crazy anyway. I mean, wouldn't you go crazy if the whole country thought you were a spy for the communists during an age of nuclear war? I mean, what else is worse than that?
You make a very good point. And for those who observed it from the outside, we saw this and, we had this kind of bizarre moment that he'd done this Reggie Perrin thing. But then he got caught quite quickly, actually, in Australia, sadly for him. I mean, he got caught December, I think, of that same year when he was transferring bags of cash between banks in Melbourne. Was his intention then to kind of stay hidden forever, or was that a kind of, I don't know, but a mistake or a cry for help, or what was it?
I mean, the thing is people say, oh, you know, he was so devious, blah, blah, blah. So he arrives in Melbourne. Less than 2 days, the police were already aware of him because there were two bank tellers. He had bank accounts in different names in these two banks, which happened to be around the corner from each other. And one day, the teller from one bank came out with for his lunchtime, you know, customary walk along Collins Street. And he saw this man he knew as Muldoon coming out of another bank. And he asked his friend there, you know, what's Mr. Muldoon doing over there? And he said, no, that's Mr. Markham. Immediately they thought, well, this must be some kind of fraud or something. They informed the police. That was less than 2 days. Now, the thing is this. My father booked into a hotel using two names. One day he booked in as Markham, and the next day he booked in as Muldoon. Totally confusing the receptionist.
Yeah.
And then he went and got a flat in Flinders Street, a little apartment thing, and he told the lady there, Mrs. Wilcox, that he was Mr. Markham, and he told Mr. Wilcox that he was Mr.
Blimey.
Muldoon.
Okay.
I mean, he didn't know who he was or what he was doing, and less than 2 days later, he was under police observation.
Wow. And from there, he was brought back and continued, really. I mean, well, you know, it was his undoing, but he came back to the UK. There was 6 months of legal wrangling before that happened, but he was still holding on to the title of MP 20 months later, even as the trial was looming. He was still there tabling questions, so which is quite remarkable. Yeah. And he made a remarkable statement, which you've heard a million times, and maybe our listeners haven't, in the Commons. And he said, I assumed a new parallel personality that took over from me, which was foreign to me, and which despised the humbug and shame of the past years of my public life. Lots of MPs go on fact-finding tours overseas. I have been on a fact-finding tour about myself. Fascinating. Yeah, yeah. Fascinating. Yeah.
I mean, he was completely disenchanted with politics. Yeah. I mean, totally disenchanted with it. He called it humbug, you know, within the family. Because, you know, as a minister, he was basically obliged to lie to the public.
Yeah.
And he knew there's lying going on left, right and centre, and he absolutely hated it. I remember one day we were at the constituency and he was giving a speech, and he got in the car. And he said, I just hate it. Because he signed the Official Secrets Act, there were things that he couldn't tell his own constituents.
Wow.
And he said, they voted for me, they trust me, and I've just gone in there and told them something that I know not to be true.
Oh.
And, you know, then we kind of drove home. And he was so upset. But this is what politicians do day in, day out.
Julie, how is that? Does that statement you've just made resonate with members of the public who are listening to this right now? Yeah.
Well, if they think that politicians don't lie, I'm sorry to burst their bubble, but I don't think anything's changed in the past 50 years.
No, I think that's right. One thing we haven't tackled is the fact that he was in a long-term affair with his secretary, Sheila Buckley, 21 years younger. That must have been very difficult indeed and devastating, I would guess, for your mother. But lots of people are philanderers. My own real father was a philanderer and a bit of a wife beater, but I didn't expect him to have to go to jail. That's not what they put people in jail for necessarily, is it? So,
No, it isn't.
You know, it's quite, in a certain period of time, and depending on where you were brought up, it was almost kind of de rigueur. Certainly where I was brought up, it seemed to be the done thing. It makes him a philanderer, but it doesn't make him, some callous man who brought a tidal wave of distress, anguish and ruin crashing down on his extended family, which are some of the things that have been said about him.
And believe me, that is all a complete exaggeration. I know exactly what you're referring to there, and I'm afraid there's a lot more going on than I should say on the radio. But no, that is nothing to do with my family. Let me tell you.
Yeah. So the book is very honest. It's very truthful. It produces facts that we have not seen before. And I think you're right. For the truth to get out there, you really need to be putting these things online, because that's where people they only believe it if they read it online these days, Julia. So the quicker you get a website up, I think probably the better.
Well, it's a very unpleasant task, because I am looking at the spy file of these people were such sleazebags, I can't tell you. And funny enough, when the defector Frolic was being interviewed by a guy on TV, Thames TV, a long time ago, he said, he asked Frolic, how many of the people at the embassy were spies? And Frolic said, it's better if you ask me how many were not spies. Mm. And out of 45 people at the embassy, 5 were not spies. So, that means 40 were. Goodness. That means if you're talking to the commercial attaché or the this, that and the other, consul this, he's probably a spy. But you don't know that. They don't go around with a label saying spy.
No. Julia, I every time I have a guest on the show, no matter what it's about, whether it's about a medical issue or a person, I think all that we can do as broadcasters is to allow people to give us sides of a story that maybe we didn't know about before, rather than just believing everything that we read blindly over the years. And then we can make our own minds up. We're all adults, and we can make a decision based on the facts. So I'm glad you've done this book, particularly given the other one that exists as well. I hope that you do get it on the web as soon as you can, traumatic though it may be. But the book is a must read. John Stonehouse, My Father, The True Story of the Runaway MP. Julia Stonehouse, been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much for coming on and being so honest.
Thank you so much, Bill, for inviting me.
Been a pleasure. Take care.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.